Hi everyone, Data Stories number 38. Hi Moritz.
Hey Enrico, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing great, and you?
Cool, yeah, good. Having good
enjoying
times here.
Enjoying summer.
Enjoying the World Cup.
The World Cup, come on, stop it.
Oh, that was a taboo. Yeah. That was a taboo subject.
How is Italy doing? Oh, sorry.
Oh, this will never end for Germans. It's always like that. They're always thinking about Italy. But I can understand that. I can understand why. Yeah.
You can support the US team now. Isn't that great?
It is fantastic, actually.
Yeah. Let's hope they make it past this round tonight. We'll see.
You know, I lived a few years in Germany, and that was fun, I can tell you.
Yeah. I know. I've been doing it for my whole life.
Yeah. Yeah, you have an interesting way of watching games.
Yeah, we're known for our playfulness, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, let's stop it there.
Let's stop the national cliches.
It's still an open wound.
Yeah, at least we're winning. I mean, just saying.
Yeah.
Anyways, okay, let's move
enough
on.
Enough is enough. We have a special guest today, Manuel Lima, on the show. Hi, Manuel.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Hey, Manuel.
Hey, great to have you here.
Yeah, finally.
Likewise.
Finally, after we've been chasing you for months, right?
Decades.
Months, I don't know.
Yeah.
Decades.
Decades, yeah. Centuries, why not?
It's the eternal fight.
Exactly.
So, usual intro, we ask our guests to introduce themselves, just in case somebody doesn't know Manuel Lima. Manuel, you want to say a few words about yourself?
Sure. Yeah, that's always the hardest thing, how to sort of characterize or introduce yourself. I guess I'm a designer by trades. I'm also an author, a researcher. I do a bit of lectures, and I also teach about design and visualization. And I also work as a design lead, a UX design lead for a startup in New York City called Code Academy. Mm-hmm. And that's about it.
Wow. That's quite a lot of things.
Quite a lot of things, yeah. That's why it's so hard to like point out exactly what you do.
How about, maybe we should start from what Scott asked on Twitter. How does he do it all?
A lot of coffee. No,
people
it's...
People swear for yerba mate. Did you try that?
Did I try what? Sorry?
Yerba mate?
No, I don't.
You know
so I haven't tried that one.
Yeah.
I like to stick with coffee, you know, all natural products.
That's great. Yeah. So Manuel, you've done so many things. I don't know exactly where to start. Maybe we should start from visual complexity, right? I think that many people out there know you for visual complexity, and that was a remarkable website that you started in very early on. When was it? 2000 what?
I started on, I think it was the summer of 2005. I started working on that. It was just after I graduated from the Master of Fine Arts at Parsons School of Design in New York. So,
No, sorry, that's going to be 10 years soon.
That's going to be 10 years soon,
crazy,
exactly.
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly,
yeah.
Which is in 10, yeah. Wow. Actually, I've been talking about this. I was actually talking to Santiago Ortiz about this, of the possibility, and this is something like still fresh in my head, but maybe doing something next year, like, mm-hmm. you know, the 10-year celebration of visual complexity, and
nice.
Who knows what could happen. And I invite all of you guys over. We can have drinks over it and then see some old projects, some relics from the past.
Is it going to be in a rooftop?
It better be, right? It depends on the season.
Yeah, otherwise I cannot come. I come only if it's a rooftop.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And if it's a full week of celebrations.
Yeah.
Otherwise the flight is just too much for me, you know?
It's not worth it. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No, please.
And I cannot talk about other requests. That's I'm going to ask in private.
No. Very good. No, but I also remember your thesis. Yeah. So it was about meme tracking, which is I think still a very interesting topic, and you were looking like how stories spread on the web, and you know the networks that you know and the trees that occur when people share stories.
Yeah,
so that's a very timely issue and has been quite prophetic for your further like the two books
I guess,
you wrote.
Yeah, I guess it was. I actually, to be honest, I fall in love with data visualization during that program at Parsons School of Design. And actually, it goes back to like this diagram of a teacher of mine that showed us during his. He was actually a very captivating speaker, Christopher Curran. But he showed us this diagram called the Understanding Spectrum by Nathan Shadroff. You've seen it. It's also known as the pyramid, the knowledge pyramid. It's how data transforms into information. Information leads into knowledge, and ultimately, knowledge leads into wisdom. And this was the first time I sort of started thinking about this deeply as, you know, what is our role as designers in this spectrum, right? And especially in converting information into knowledge and hopefully wisdom in the end. And that stuck with me forever. And I think then, you know, towards my thesis, I knew I wanted to do something related to visualization, at least that could explore the value and benefits of data visualization. And as you pointed out, Moritz, it was very much about memetics. It was trying to understand how the idea of words, word of mouth, the idea of information diffusion, which is actually something that has been intriguing to social sciences for a long, long time. This way, for centuries. Now we can actually use the word centuries. But, you know, with the internet, especially with the blogs, the blogosphere, the blog space, this sort of behavior, information spreads from person to person, became a lot easier to track. And the sort of the most obvious sort of analogy we made in that process was how, you know, one specific topic, you know, starts being spread in one specific blog, and now it's sort of appropriated by other blogs who sort of retweeted and reposted, and this creates a huge sort of diffusion of that meme, right? It's the definition of memetics, which for me was very interesting, and I wanted to visualize that, which, as you were saying, Maurice, is actually something that has been going. It's been constantly surfacing. Even recently, about, 2 years ago, I was actually involved in a project at Microsoft Research trying to do exactly the same thing, but in this case using Twitter, seeing how, you know, someone tweets something for the very first time and then how seeing how that meme, that piece of information spreads across Twitter, which is really, really fascinating, again, for social sciences to understand. And then during that process, I was trying to visualize this in the most meaningful way, and this is how my thesis was born, BlogViz, mapping the patterns of diffusion across blog space, and which I actually say is a website that I still maintain, even though I haven't done any changes at all since I graduated, which it's always like that sense of like, you know, I want to go back to it, I want to sort of expand, I want to improve it, but then you just never find yourself the time to do it. But afterwards, you know, after graduating and after done the thesis, I was finding myself with a lot of time on my hands. I started working for RGA, which is a sort of the design, the sort of digital agency here in New York. And then all of a sudden, I have entire weekends with nothing else to do because I was used to like one full year of like hardcore work, working on my thesis for school. So all of a sudden, I had like all this time in my hands, which was really, really kind of strange for the first time. In 1 year or so, and that's
you're
why
the first man I meet who starts work at an ad agency and says like he has too much time.
I know, which probably says a lot to how busy we were.
Says
like
a lot about you.
Maybe, but and then during that research, like one of the things that was really fascinating to me, like as I was trying to sort of understand the logic of the blog space and how information spreads across the particular network that comprises the World Wide Web, I was collecting all these really cool, interesting examples of networks, of people visualizing networks, but not just, you know, the web. I was collecting things like food webs, you know, computer systems, social networks, protein networks, biological networks, etc., etc. Mm-hmm. I was really trying to understand the variety of ways people are using, the variety of models and approaches people are using to visualize any type of network. And I found that research was like so interesting that I should probably open it up to the public. And this is why, in many ways, Visual Complexity was born, just straight after graduating from Parsons, just to open it up, a lot of that knowledge, a lot of that research, to the general public. And then, of course, I started expanding it considerably over months and years.
Mm-hmm. So it was first your personal archive of project references, and then at some point you decided to put it online?
Exactly.
That's exactly what it was. Great. And it's been a hugely popular resource, I think, on the web, right?
I think it was. I think at the time there was not, as you guys can probably recall, 10 years ago there was not a lot of things online about visualization. I think Infostatics had just came out like maybe 6 months or a year before. There was no flowing data. There was no. I think Eager Eyes was not there yet.
Yeah, maybe in the beginning.
Maybe, I don't know, but a lot of the new blogs that are major references right now for the community were probably not there at the time. So I think that's one, I think, the reasons why Infostatics and Visual Complexity were so important for people starting and sort of initiating themselves into this field to have those points of reference of projects that have been made in the past, but also projects that people were involved all around the world in different areas, showcasing different styles and approaches and so on.
So I'm just curious to hear, how did Visual Complexity evolve since when you started? So the Visual Complexity, the way it is today, is it very similar to the way it was when you started, or there was some kind of development through the years?
Yeah, quite similar. I mean, I remember one time I changed the design of the site a little bit, just to be a little bit more friendly, just to show sort of better resolution images up front on the homepage. And I think over time, I just added more categories, more metadata to all the projects. So now you can filter projects in a variety of ways, by the year they were created, by the author's name, by the tools that they are using, by the general sort of theme or topic that they are sort of exploring. So that was, most of the things that I added. And then I think slowly I added other categories like, referential books that people might be interested in, and a few other enhancements, and of course a blog at some point. But it hasn't really evolved that much. I think it was just like small additions over time.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Okay.
But of course, as it's been pretty hard, as you guys can probably notice, and some people who are watching us can notice, it hasn't been updated very frequently since over, I think, maybe since the book came out, since Visual Complexity came out.
Yeah, I think fine, right? I mean,
yeah, I think it's fine, because I think one of the things that was very positive for me was at least it kind of like minimized my sort of pressure to always be posting stuff on Visual Complexity, is that Visual Complexity, in a way, some people call it a blog, but I never thought of it as a blog per se, in the sense that, you have this sort of bits of information that are always like chronologically organized with the most up-to-date on the top, and then you really eagerly wait for the next post to come out. I never sort of suffered that sort of pressure to like constantly put stuff out. It was, I always seen it as an archive, that can grow and sort of expand over time, but it's not sort of committed to like a given time frame for it to sort of constantly.
It's not a news site in any way. It's like you can also add an old project, right? And nobody will complain. Yeah. And I think that's a great quality of the site, as compared to, let's say, Flowing Data or Infostatics, which have always followed the blogging model. And then once you have a few hundred posts or so, right? How do you organize them, and how do you make that an archive as well? It's a tough challenge if you start off with this like constant output and the blogging model. And I like how you very early already saw it as an archive and just designed the whole site around that.
Yeah, and to be honest, I have actually a list of things that I've been maintaining over the years and adding to it over the years. A list of things that I want to do on the site, enhancements I want to do on the site. There's a variety of ideas and things I want to expand upon. Right. But, time is always an issue. And I think over time also, the fact that this was never my full-time job. You know, I got a little bit of money out of, you know, some Google ads and whatnot, but it doesn't really like pay the bills at all.
Yeah,
if anything.
Yeah, of course.
You might pay for a dinner once a month, you know. So,
as everyone who ever attempted this knows very well, it's not
exactly.
as easy as it looks like.
Exactly. Well, but then of course you have, you know, the case of full-time bloggers, you know, people that reach a threshold of like really, you know, in the order of like thousands and millions of readers. So when you reach that level, you can probably make, you know, a comfortable living out of a blog, and then of course the motivation to keep updating it and maintaining it in a proper way is an entirely different game, right? I think that was never the case for me. So I think over time you have a tendency to just, I wouldn't say abandon it, but leaving it in the periphery somehow.
Yeah, I think. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you have right now. You have 777 projects.
Correct.
So that's hard to like to add one to that beautiful number. No, but anyway,
exactly.
I mean, there is only a limited amount of things you can do with the network, right? And I think probably, you know, you're covering the ground pretty well. So I don't think there's so much pressure also to add stuff. I think it totally
Yeah, you're right. You're right. I think, but to be honest, like I was thinking about this lately about, you know, reaching the 1,000, you know, that would be the final mark.
That would be nice.
And then,
yeah.
But reaching the 1,000 projects and reaching that milestone, mm-hmm. next year, the summer of 2015, which is like the 10-year anniversary of the project.
Oh, that would be awesome.
Yeah. And then, like doing the party around that, and then, you know,
and then you freeze it forever.
Yeah, exactly. Then it's like frozen in time, but at least it's always available. People, you know, get to sort of play with it.
That's brilliant.
Well, actually, one of the things that's pretty hard actually about a digital archive, which could be a segue for like Visual Complexity, the book, is actually the amount of dead links over time that you start accumulating. I don't know right now what is the percentage, but probably if you explore all the projects on Visual Complexity, maybe I would argue maybe 10, if not more, 10% or more are entirely dead links. You know, projects that have been sort of abandoned, people have like removed the URLs from the websites. There's a bunch of projects like that, which is very unfortunate. And but at least we got the thumbnail. So at least we have a very small sort of visual representation of that project.
But that sounds the kind of thing that you can try to outsource, to crowdsource, and try to fix it, right? Did you ever thought
I guess
of
it? Could.
Yeah, but some projects are actually gone. So I also realized that. So I did for a few projects research on older stuff, and as you said, like a lot of the early stuff is actually gone. Like the domain is gone, or the whole, I don't know, they switched to a new system and the project isn't there anymore. It happens, yeah.
Yeah,
it happens. I mean, even recently when I was doing my second book, The Book of Trees, I was actually trying to look for the project Ekotonoa. Uh-huh. You guys remember that one from Yugo Nakamura?
Yeah, the nice tree.
It was a nice tree that you can post sort of messages on the tree. And then the URL was gone. It was actually sponsored, I think, by NEC, by the technology company. And it was just like abandoned. It was just, you know, it was not in their own interest to maintain that website. Because as you know, like it costs time and money to maintain a lot of those domains. And then people over time just don't see any value and then they abandon it. And the unfortunate thing is that I guess all of us kind of lose part of that process, our species, because a lot of those projects are really, you know, interesting cultural artifacts that reflect sort of the way of thinking of a given time, of a given moment in time. And when you start losing a lot of that stuff is problematic because you don't have ways of retrieving it again, which is, you know, slightly concerning at least.
Right.
I mean, I don't lose like nights, you know, sleep nights over it, but still it's something that has been very much of a concern for myself.
Sure. And I'm just curious to hear, is there a reason why so when you started, you already focused on exclusively networks on Visual Complexity?
Yeah, I don't know what drawed me necessarily to networks. I think it was the
maybe
challenge.
The fact that everything's connected.
Yeah, but I think it was also the challenge. Yeah, exactly. Everything is connected. And yeah, maybe I was actually, I probably know exactly what it was. I read Barabasi's Linked even before I started working on my thesis, right?
That's a dangerous read, yeah.
Yeah, that was totally big difference. So it was like Maurice was saying, like the realization of everything is totally interconnected and interdependent. I think that was, and then I read, I think following that book or even before that book, I read Emergence by Stephen Johnson, which also plays this idea of networks. It actually goes in deep into networks and interdependence and emergent behavior, all that. And I think I was really getting really so interested. But I think it was also, from a visualization point of view, was also because it's probably the most challenging of every topic you might think about visualizing. Networks tend to be the most complex one, the most harder to sort of decipher. Yeah. I think it was that element of difficulty that sort of engaged me. It's like, you know, I'm not so interested in like, you know, simple things. I think the complex ones are the ones that, you know, makes you sort of engage and passionate and sort of like the strive for understanding. And I think that was really what sort of motivated me the most about networks.
Just so a random thought, but did you know there's a German author who published a book called Visual Simplexity?
I heard about it.
<It's like you. laughs>
Actually, I think that was even a blog. There might even be a blog called Visual Simplicity or something.
It's an open invitation for a fight, obviously. I mean,
exactly. Maybe it's going to be the 10-year anniversary. We invite those and then have like a panel.
Battle it out.
Battle it out, exactly.
So, Manuel, how did you transition to the book then?
The book, well, I think the book was, I think it was the motivation was really much what we talked about. I think at some point I realized that this archive was growing, that people were, you know, at least some people were interested in its contents, and just the realization of a lot of these projects being gone, as we were talking, right? A lot of URLs being sort of abandoned, domains being closed, servers being down, etc. And the realization that a lot of these interesting cultural artifacts, which they are, all of them, in each different way, is a cultural artifact, they were being gone forever. And I think the book came as an idea of not just expanding sort of the audience of the website, which was growing, but still I think with the book you can reach, you know, other types of audience, as other types of users that are interested in this type of material. And the second reason was, again, saving this material for posterity. And I think it goes back to this the realization of, I think I talked to Moritz actually about this, the idea of the digital dark ages. So I don't know if you heard about this, Enrico, but the digital dark ages is something really interesting to me. It's this theory of this prospect that some point in the future, we're going to look back to the current time and not being able to sort of understand what we are producing, all the digital artifacts that we are creating. And this is not really hard to imagine, as, you know, plugins keep on disappearing, you know, formats, file formats keep on changing, proprietary formats keeps on changing. So all of that is really not that difficult to sort of understand. Again, a lot of these projects sort of vanishing from services and so on. So I think that's something that was definitely a concern to me. And the benefit of a book still in a printed format is that it can probably outlast by far any website that we create nowadays. It has this sort of like intemporal sort of presence that a website, I think most websites will struggle to have in many different ways. So I think that was, you know, the ultimate sort of goal of like putting all this material in a book that people can use, not just of this generation, but hopefully other generations in the future, and look back at the kind of interesting work that we were doing right now.
Okay, so I really want to understand. So did you conceptualize the book as some sort of printed archive then? So did you as a way for people to just flip through the pages and look at these images? Or you had a broader concept.
The first book especially had a big text part to it as well.
Yeah,
right?
that's
attempt to sort of categorize all these different ways to visualize networks and reflect on why is it the age of networks and what does that mean and things like that.
Totally. I think that's a really good point. That's a really good point, Enrico. And to be honest, I never saw it entirely as an archive. And I think it was an opportunity to also reflect, as Moritz is pointing out, a little bit on the role of networks, you know, on the change that network is bringing, not just as a visualization metaphor or model, but as a way of looking at thinking about the world around us, right? So that sort of shift in this sort of paradigm shift in the way that we are understanding the world around us, and networks and network science is a great sort of drive for that shift. And I wanted to reflect a little bit upon that. But now thinking about it after the book is done, I think I did the worst thing you could ever do, which is you do a bit of a coffee table book and a lot of like heavy textbook, which is probably the worst any author can do in the sense that so writing is really hard enough, right? And you spend a lot of time writing and, you know, putting your thoughts together and organizing it in a meaningful way. And then, and that's, you know, already a lot of work. And then if you decide to do just a coffee table book, then you lose a lot of time also like collecting images, you know, managing rights and permissions and all that, you know, cleaning up the images at times, all that, which is another huge chunk of work. So doing those two things in tandem for one single volume, it's a nightmare, especially because it was my first one and I did know all the shortcuts and the processes to minimize the amount of rework and so on. So yeah. It was definitely like looking in inside. It was really, really hard.
How long did it take you? I remember you were working at Nokia at the time in London, right?
Yeah. Yes. I was working at Nokia at the time. And then I got an invite to actually talk at TED Global in Oxford, UK. And then it was, as you guys can imagine, it was like one of the most sort of mind-blowing experiences of my lifetime, and not just, you know, being there in Oxford, which is a sort of a city, you know, sort of heavy with history and knowledge and wisdom, but also like being surrounded by all those minds and talking to all of those minds. So after that, I remember being on the train back to London. On that train, I decided to leave my job, my current well-paid, very comfortable job at Nokia, and dedicate myself for 6 months writing the book on my own.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Cool. And that's what I did. So the following Monday, I went to my manager at the time in Nokia, say, you know, I love working here. It's a great job, and I love the work we're doing, but I would love to dedicate myself to, like, for 6 months just writing the book. And that's what happened. So it was it was a really hard time, as my wife can attest to. It was a really tough 6 months.
Yeah.
So do you mean tough because it was a lot of work, or because it was demanding from the psychological point of view, or both?
Both. Oh, absolutely, yeah. Both. I think it was you know, the pressure of not knowing if what you're doing is the right thing.
Yeah.
But also, you know, it was my first book, so I don't know, like, the editing part. I realized very naively at the time that the book, when it comes to the writing part, has to be perfect. You know, like, every single dot needs to be in place. Yeah, and, of course, that's not the case. There's, like, 3 or 4 editing processes that happen afterwards. So I wouldn't say that you have to be sloppy in the first draft, but you don't have to be that perfectionist with the first draft. So, you know, things like that you learn over time. And I think for the second book now, it was a lot easier because I knew a lot of these processes and sort of shortcuts. So it was tough because of that, because I didn't know all that the shortcuts, and just the amount of work was impressive. Just, you know, the writing part, but also getting all the images and permissions. And it was really, really time consuming. I think my email inbox is always, for any book actually, for both books, is really, really tricky. I have like flags of every color. I try to do like color coordination and all of that, try to find order in the chaos of my email inbox, because it's really hard. But again, without many of those authors, you know, this couldn't really exist. So
I'm just wondering, so for your first book, for Visual Complexity, you've basically been using the archive that you already had on the website, or you've been doing additional research there?
Oh, I did a lot of additional research, yes. I mean, one of the sort of initial research that actually became sort of the building blocks for what ended up becoming my second book was a research I did on trees, on ancient trees and tree visualization, which was the first chapter of Visual Complexity, which is called The Tree of Life. So all of that was like entirely new. Even the second chapter was fairly new. I think I had given a few lectures on that topic, but it was all about the paradigm shift between trees and networks, and you know, for centuries, even millennia, we have used the tree metaphor, the tree model, as a way of visualizing and explaining the world around us, from, you know, the areas of science to how the brain operates, to how cities operate, to, you know, religion, to sort of moral conduct, to systems of law. We have used this metaphor of the tree. And what's interesting is how networks are actually replacing the metaphor entirely in many of these topics, in many of these sort of areas of human knowledge. So that's why I mentioned sort of this paradigm shift, and I need to introduce trees, and I had to introduce trees as a first chapter of the book to then provide a little bit more guidance towards the shift and then expand deeply into networks. And I think that was the corpus of visual complexity, the website, on the following chapters.
Yeah.
Okay.
But still, you had to go back and make a project selection and get print-ready graphics, you know, in addition to all this theory.
Oh, part. Yeah.
So I can totally see how that's...
I think the hardest one was I think the hardest one was the taxonomy. I think it was on chapter 5, you know, the syntax of a new language, which has been, I think, the most loved and the most sort of criticized by some people, which is always hard, you know, as any taxonomy, any sort of type of ontology that you want to create on any given topic, especially being the first, you're always going to, you know, go through some holes and some problems. But, you know, it was an attempt of like trying to understand all the different sort of models and visualization approaches and methodologies that people are using, and try to organize and categorize them in a meaningful way.
So did you have some reviews before the paper was published?
No, it was before the book was published.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, what did I say? Well, paper? Yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, sorry.
The academic.
Guess what?
Yeah. It was good. No, I had some reviews afterward, which was great. I mean, it was, you know, fairly well received. I got, you know, reviews from the New York Times and a few others. So it was definitely well received, and that people could realize the importance of this discussion, you know, this topic of visualizing networks, because it's still very present in many of the things we address and think about on a daily basis. You know, when you think about, you know, political ties and sort of networks of influence and in biology, I mean, network really pervades any sort of field we can think of. So it is so present and so important. And I think this book somehow contributed to that discussion and, you know, made people sort of reflect a little bit more, I guess, about the importance of visualizing many of these of these territories and platforms and domains.
Yeah, and I think it opened like a whole new audience for this whole like this nerdy data visualization world, because I think you managed so well to bring in like the art aspect and the science aspect, and I think in the end it worked out that it's both a coffee table as well as a theory book. You know, like from the end product, it might not have been the smartest thing like for your like work-life balance, but I think for the book, for the book it worked out.
Yeah, that was good.
That's
a good point. Yeah. I think actually probably my favorite chapter, and I think some people say the same, was the chapter, the complex beauty chapter, which goes deep into art you know, comparisons with fractals and Pollocks and that one was also really hard, because, you know, how can you sort of try to explain, you know, if there's any sort of intricate sort of attachment in this sort of appeal for networks on a visual sort of emotional level, how can you explain that? Mm-hmm. You know, when you see like a great sort of network visualization, there's almost this intricate sort of visceral appeal that it has on us as human beings. So how can you explain that? So I sort of pose a few sort of theories on possible sort of theories on how to explain that inherent appeal, you know, taking that to the work of Pollock and other sort of scientists and whatnot. So I think it was a really interesting sort of chapter. And also to see, again, this boundary between science and art, and now many artists are being influenced by a lot of the visualization work we are doing, as, you know, scientists, researchers, and designers are doing. Right. So it is a very symbiotic process, which is really interesting to me as well.
Yeah. Cool. So, and you hinted at it a bit, but in the end, I found it really funny that at some point you said, like, and now I'm writing a book about trees. And I was like, you were bashing trees in the first book. Like, you said, this is the thing of the past. You know, it's gone.
Totally.
Nobody needs them anymore. We have
networks. Who cares about
now.
Trees?
Yeah, exactly. And then you were like, yeah, might write a book about trees. So how did that happen? Did you want to escape yourself or what's going on?
No. Well, I mean, you're right. I mean, I was bashing the trees not so much as, again, a visualization model, but as a way of understanding the world around us, in the sense that, you know, if you think about systems or domains that are, you know, highly centralized and dependent on that core of that CEO and that sort of centralized command. Mm-hmm. And you think about these very, you know, hierarchical sort of processes. Though, I mean, all of us involved in technology and sort of the new age, the new digital age, we realize how some of those concepts are already outdated. You know, it's more about networks and, you know, decentralization and sort of flatten out the process, because there's a lot of benefits that can come from that. Right. But still, it's really interesting to me how trees were, again, used for centuries and millennia even as the visualization model of choice of like numerous researchers and authors and illustrators and so on. Mm-hmm. So there's something really, really appealing about trees at the same time, that even though we are facing this paradigm shift, there's something really, again, appealing to us at a very intricate level. So I think the book, and because I did that introduction for Visual Complexity, the Tree of Life in the first chapter, I think I immediately realized that this story was too beautiful, too powerful, too strong to be left to a single chapter on a book about networks, right? And I felt it was... that chapter needed a whole volume and a whole entire book dedicated to that specific visual metaphor. And that's why it was born. Two reasons, I think, was one was really to tell this untold story, because in many ways, you know, some people reference trees and there's like other, you know, very philosophical books talk about tree as a metaphor and so on. But there has never been, at least to my knowledge, a dedicated book on this metaphor. One that covers, you know, so much, you know, space and time, and so many different domains of knowledge. So that was a beautiful story that I think had to be told, and that was my main motivation to putting the book together. Just again, telling this untold story, and tell it in a very sort of pluralistic, universal way. And then I think the second point that was very much the goal of putting this book together, my latest one, The Book of Trees, was also to somehow oppose our present bias, you know, the idea of presentism, which I think all of us are, you know, very eager to like open our Twitter app and our Facebook app and just, you know, eagerly wait for the latest post. And I think that could be fun, but at the same time, it could be problematic because it somehow blinds us from seeing the big picture, and the big picture being all the stuff that happened in the past. And I think I wanted to sort of convey this sort of long history of information visualization. Mm-hmm. And I think if you look at most of the books that are written in this topic, they go probably, if they want to provide any sort of contextual sort of information, they go maybe as far as the 18th or 19th century as a foundation of information visualization.
Right.
And it's true. I mean, there's a lot of really interesting people back then that were doing a lot of interesting work. But I think it's really unfair to think there was nothing else before that time. That was just not a blank state. It's impossible to think that was just a blank state. So I think the book tries to sort of prove that, you know, this is not a new thing. I think it's too easy for us to think of visualization as this new discipline, you know, rising to meet the demands of the new century, which is very poetic, but at the same time, not true. So I think the book tries to sort of show this long evolution of visualization by, you know, through through the lens of the tree figure, through the lens of the tree visual metaphor. Mm-hmm. And it's also like telling this meta narrative, this sort of, what I think is really interesting for me is that if you look at many books on history, right, they concentrate either on a very sort of specific civilization or space, right? So ancient Babylon, ancient Rome, the Incas, etc. Or they focus on a very specific time, right, the 12th century, the 15th century, the Age of Enlightenment, the Digital Age. But I think those books tend to suffer from being too self-contained, right? And so for me, those stories are interesting to a given point. But the most interesting stories for me are the ones that really traverse time and space. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They're the ones that really are narratives of narratives, you know, this idea of a meta narrative. Mm-hmm. And I think the tree is one of those meta narratives. It's again a model that again traverses time and space that you can find in any society across the world and almost any given point in time. So there's something really, really appealing about this, which again had to be conveyed in a book. Sorry if I extended a little bit too long.
No, that totally makes sense. Okay. And I think it's a great perspective. And And you are right. It's fascinating, not just as a visualization model, but actually because I think it's a tool for thought. Like, you know, the whole tree model is a basic way of thinking. And with you, like, exploring all these connections in the past, we get to learn so much about how people thought in the past. And I hadn't seen it from that way. Yeah, it's very nice.
Yeah, well, as you're saying, Maurice, it has even influenced the way we talk and communicate with each other. You know, when you say the bank opened a new branch, or you know, you're going to branch out to this new thing, or the root of a problem. All those metaphors we use biology is a branch of science. You know, all those metaphors we use on a day-to-day basis are based on that visual metaphor. You know, on the metaphor of all these topics being organized as a tree. As you find, for instance, the idea of science or knowledge being organized as a tree goes back to Ramon Llull, one of the Spanish scholars, one of the scholars that actually talk extensively on the Book of Trees, because it was really the foundation of many of these concepts. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's really interesting how it's not just like a visual model to represent knowledge. It's really so ingrained in our brains and the way we think about the world around us and many of the subjects we like to sort of debate.
Yeah, and I think what is really interesting is that today we are so entrenched into this idea that visualization is about visualizing data and possibly a lot of data. But some of these examples show that actually visuals have been used for a long time just as a way to take some information that is in your head and put it out there so that you can see it with your eyes and go through much deeper reasoning, right? And also, of course, for communication of important ideas. So I think that's another interesting angle or things that you actually realize when you see these old images that are really, really beautiful.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the thing for me, that if you bypass entirely this discussion about what is the right label to call our discipline, if you bypass that entirely, you're going to realize that, you know, the goals of all these people doing this magnificent work back in, you know, the 12th century or the 13th century, the goals, the motivations were entirely the same as our motivations right now. They were trying trying by means of visualization to, you know, simplify and clarify, you know, to provide insight, to educate an audience, to provide, you know, they were really like a lot of the metaphors that we're using, primarily the tree, were strong visualization metaphors and models to provide and to sort of solve the same problems as we're facing now. It's really not that different. So again, if you bypass all the idea of nomenclature and what is the right name to call what we do, which is always like a tricky subject, you find out that at least from a sort of purpose point of view, it's entirely the same. It hasn't really changed that much at all.
Here's a practical question. How did you find all these old graphics? Like, did you just type a cool old tree into Google and take the first page? How do you do that?
That's really hard. The new ones are fairly easy because I think all of us are exposed to like new projects that are coming out, and we know like the main ones that that deal with trees or any sort of other visualization metaphors. The old ones, as you're pointing out, Moritz, is definitely one of the hardest. And I think fortunately for, you know, researchers or curious researchers like myself, it's great. And the internet is providing this sort of new platform and seeing how many museums and galleries, like, you know, the British Library, the Library of France, the Spanish Library, the Metropolitan Museum, a lot of these critical institutions are finally opening up their archives and putting all this material online and available for free for people to use and research, which is great, but that's just the beginning, right? So the beginning is, you know, knowing what resources you can use. You know, a lot of those references, you know, like the British Library, for instance, has been an invaluable resource, as well as the National Library of France. But then it's also knowing what to look for, as you're saying, Maurice. I had to like know how to spell tree in maybe 10 languages, you know, from German to Italian to Portuguese to Spanish to like every single language that could be important to retrieve that information. Right. And then sometimes even when you find the illustration, there's no more information about it. That's it. If you're lucky, maybe there's like the ear, there's maybe the author. And then this is where the real fun begins, you know, like when the really sort of hardcore research starts. Try to sort of find more information about the author, about, you know, his life or her life, about the context surrounding that person, you know, what was happening around him, etc. It's just, you know, historical research, basically, to sort of like portray this, you know, why that person made this chart in such a way, the influences and so on.
Yeah. So you've been relying exclusively on digital media, or you've been also going to into places and looking at the original file, the original documents?
I did, but you know what? I think it's really, unfortunately, it's actually a lot harder to go to physical places, not just because you
traveling the old world. Yeah.
But it's also like it's just so lost in time. It's just like the processes. There's so much bureaucracy to like even sort of request one of those ancient manuscripts. There's a lot of processes. I mean, I remember when I was in London and I was doing some research on that, I went to the British Library, which is, you know, I think the second biggest library in the world. They have a lot of, a ton of really interesting material and old manuscripts. But it was just so hard to get it sent. Then you cannot copy it. There's nothing you can do because, of course, a lot of these materials are like extremely sort of valuable. It was just a lot harder. So I think you can do that, but I think you waste a lot more time in doing so. And that's therefore, but again, before that was the only option. You know, fortunately now, a lot of these, you know, critical institutions are releasing to the general public a lot of this material, which is great for, again, people like myself interested in a lot of this material.
Yeah. There's like a million images from the British Library and the Rijksmuseum in Holland. In the Netherlands has opened a lot of images. And yeah. I'm also still waiting until like really nice collections of historical like illustrations and and diagrams and so on are compiled based on that. Yeah.
So did you ever think about having exhibitions?
As a big center about like this old, I was approached by a few people. I think that was an idea of curating maybe an exhibit on this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would definitely. I don't think why. Now that I try to think about, I don't know why that actually never happened, but I think it could be something that might happen in the future. I think that would be great, actually. Like,
that'd be fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, gathering a lot of these like the real thing, right?
Yeah.
And showcase it to people. Yeah, that would be actually great. Yeah.
Yeah, there's actually two good connections. So, you know, Michael Stoll, the professor from Augsburg, he has a huge collection of historical stuff. And I think if you would dig through his archives, specifically for Treason Networks, that would be very like, there could be a lot of stuff already.
Nice. Yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What excuses to have fun?
Exactly. Exactly.
So, Manuel, so you've been doing this thing for a very long time now, right? Mm. So we just said that visual complexity started almost 10 years ago. So I'm curious to hear from you. I'm wondering if you feel like giving us a broad perspective on how you see this developing, right? So you've been watching for many years, and I'm sure that you've been seeing this thing developing, right? Mm. As I think it's the same for everyone here. And so do you have any thoughts about how this it was when you started, how it is now? Do you think that something important has changed since then? And how do you see this developing in the future as well?
That's a good point. I don't know. Definitely a lot of things have changed, right? And yes, since we were talking about this like 10 years ago, that was not almost like maybe just a few blogs, a couple of blogs talking about this subject. And now you probably, I don't even know how many exist out there. Some of them are actually very specific. They concentrate only one specific methodology and so on. So that's really the change. I think the major change is like the level of interest. You know, like this has been growing exponentially, right? Not just the people involved in the field, but also the interest from people outside the field, from media to again, political parties to anyone you can think of has probably already heard of this term visualization when 10 years ago, that was definitely not the case. So that's one positive aspect, just the growth of sort of awareness of this discipline has grown a lot considerably. I think partly due to the reason that it has been somehow attached to the big data phenomenon, this side of burst of interest for big data. So there's definitely a positive thing. I think, as the community grows, as more people get involved in this battle for understanding I think there's a lot of benefits that can come from it, you know, because we need as many brains as possible to like face the challenges of this new society, this new sort of complex, interconnected world that we are living on. So that's a great thing. But of course, you know, with the growth of a field, then you have aspects that are not so great, you know, like the birth of this infographic with capital letters or things like of that kind.
Like that.
But those are
the
I think
all
those
caps
are just,
infographic.
Exactly, the all caps infographic. Yeah, exactly. So, but I think all of that is just a byproduct of any field growing. There's always those kind of byproducts, which for me, it's just only natural that those will occur and will continue occurring. When it comes to the future, I really don't know. I think one of the things I would like to see a lot more is, and I think that's happening as technology also like follows us, which is, you know, leaving these small screens behind. You know, I think we are still very constrained and limited by the size of our screens. And that ultimately limits what we can do from a visualization standpoint and an interaction standpoint as well, right? So exploring like large platforms that we can sort of explore information in a much deeper immersive way, I think that could be definitely the future moving forward. And if we extrapolate that, you can think about intelligence and sort of, you know, intelligence sort of systems and objects around us conveying information, maybe the color white on my wall right now is not white, just arbitrarily white. It's probably conveying some level of information. Then, of course, you have these deeply immersive systems like the Allosphere. Have you guys heard of the Allosphere?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
In the University of Santa. I've never been there. I wish I actually met the main researcher at one of the conferences a while back, but I never actually went there in person. But
what
I would love
that,
to go.
So I'm not aware of it.
Yeah, so the Allosphere is like a two-story high sphere in they created in the University of Santa Barbara in California. And it's meant to be this like super high-tech, all immersive environment for visualizing different aspects of science. And the interesting thing is that they don't only visualize, but they play with other senses. So they play, I think, with sound, and they play with other things. So it's truly like an all-immersive, multisensorial experience. And I think those are signs of change that are really interesting to me when it comes to leaving these small screens behind and really getting ourselves immersed with meaningful sort of information and data. Mm-hmm. I think those are the signs of some future interest for me. And also, I think when it comes to visual metaphors, one of the things I've been sort of realizing by doing a lot of this research is how many of the metaphors we consider to be new, very recently, are actually quite old.
None of them.
None of them. Like, if you think about, you know, arc diagrams that, you know, Martin Wartenberg famously sort of populated, the project became really famous by introducing this arc diagram metaphor. I think it was The Shape of Song. That metaphor has been used in medieval times to actually map, guess what, music. And there's like tons of examples. When you think about tree maps, of course, Ben Schneiderman invented the sort of the modern version of the tree map, the one that can actually sort of subdivide in multiple ways. He created the algorithm that allows that sort of process to exist. But the idea of a tree map is much older. It goes back to, you know, the 19th, if not the 18th century. So a lot of these metaphors that we somehow think are new and reflect this new age of visualization, many of them have existed for centuries. So I think that the next challenge for us is to get away of this cyclicality of reusing the same metaphor on and on and on. And somehow, and this is, I know it's like, it seems pretty easy to say, but I think, yeah, we need hard challenges to solve. I think one of those hard challenges is like coming up with new visual metaphors that can really solve the problems that we are facing in a much better way. I think
a
lot of the visual.
Sorry for interrupting. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, please.
No, I'm just asking. So you think that the design space is still, so there are parts of the design space that have not been explored yet?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, there's so much more to explore. Absolutely. I would like to believe that's the case. Otherwise, that's not like so much of a future, that, you know, the future prospect of like continually sort of regurgitating the same metaphors is not super appealing to me or to future generations, right? Yeah. I would imagine.
And then I would be jobless too.
I mean. Yeah, I would
In a way, you can see maybe that's just the way humanity evolves, right? Every time a new idea is just repurposing an old idea, but every time we do that, we make it more refined and maybe better, right? Maybe that's the same with ideas themselves, right?
That's a great point. you're totally right, and I think that might well be
If you look at history of philosophy or whatever, even politics or ways to organize society, or I don't know, I think you can name
everything,
so many different things.
Fashion, so on.
So maybe it's just in human nature, the fact that we are reinventing stuff that have been invented already, but every time we do that, we do it in a slightly different way, or we learn something new. Or it's just that it adapts to the new context. I don't know. I mean, I'm not an expert on this topic.
That's a super valid point. And I think that's also the value of looking at history, which is something that I'm you know, as you guys probably can tell by now, I'm a strong advocate of history, because it allows us to really understand this cyclical nature, these cyclical patterns of many disparate fields. And visualization is definitely one of those fields that's probably going to suffer from that same cyclical nature of things evolving. And, you know, it's almost like when you join a new company, right? Well, I guess you guys are slightly independent, but, you know, Enrico, let's say, or Maurice, let's say you would like to join a company tomorrow. If you are involved in any sort of creative job, the first thing you want to know is, okay, so what have you guys done in the past?
Right,
and, you know, what was well received? If it was abandoned, why was it abandoned? Like, you want to have as much knowledge as possible so that when you try and propose something else, something new, it doesn't repeat the mistakes from the past. And I think that's the value of looking at history. You know, that's why in many societies, the elders are held to such a high standard, because they have that increasing sort of knowledge of past mistakes. And that's the only way we can evolve. And because we have that sort of collective memory, we are actually the only species that have this collective memory that, you know, that can adapt and change generation after generation. So for me, that's really the value of history, that provides us that meaningful understanding of the cyclical nature of things, and our subjects change and you know, happen throughout a lot of these, you know, very intrinsic patterns.
Yeah, and I mean, some things in culture and tradition are the way they are because they're universal principles and they just make sense, right? So maybe the trees are a good example there. And other things are just like that because there's certain technological limitations at a given time, or there's just, stuff has happened and it's been repeated, but it doesn't have to be that way. And so these things you can like start to question and sort of innovate on these. So I'm not so... I think there's lots of space for innovation, even if we all play the same songs all over again.
I agree. Yeah. I would definitely like to hope so. But I definitely agree that's the case.
Can you tell us a bit what you're doing now? Like, you're working as a user experience designer mostly, is that right?
That's right. Well, yeah, that's my, you know, 9 to 5, well, 9 to 7 job at Code Academy. Yeah. So I'm leading a small team of product designers or UX designers, you know, trying to grow the team, hire more designers, and, you know, really change and affect the product in a positive way. We actually just launched a massive redesign of the products, you know, from a branding standpoint, but also like a massive redesign of you know, the interface, the website, and so on. So it's a really, really interesting challenge, because you have a chance for like great impact, and it's very direct. You know, you don't have like all the layers of decision making and sort of bureaucracy that you have in other places. Yeah. So the impact is like straight.
Yeah, if you change something on the website, people will complain or like it or not. And so
exactly, yeah. Exactly. It's so fast. I think that's one of the things that it's really this idea when we talk about creativity and technology and look upon the future. Mm-hmm. I think startups are so interesting sort of phenomenons, because they allow us to like sort of try and fail really fast. You know, like fail, learn from that mistake, and then like repeat it and change it. You know, change one small component every time. And that's the best way to learn. That's the best way to sort of evolve. And large companies don't have that luxury. That's why they are so slow to adapt. Sure, that's why they're so sort of, you know, big, small, big sort of big, slow elephants, which makes it really harder to compete with all those, you know, new startups.
Right. And so, yeah, I think what did you say? How does your, like, your experiences from the visualization things and visual complexity, how does it influence your job? Is that more like the one thing is play and the other one is work? Or do you see a lot of parallels like between these worlds? Like, how does it go together?
They've always like been separate. And I never intentionally sort of... I never intentionally try to merge them. Maybe there's that aspect of, you know, if you start having lobster every single day, you might get sick of it. So there is that element of, like, you know, leaving something that you really like as a hobby, you know, that you do on the side, because that's, you know, where your passion is coming from. That's kind of like your free sort of private moment that you have to yourself. So there's something really interesting about that. But at the same time, I have to say, and you probably know this pretty well, Moritz, because I think your background is actually in traction design. There's a lot of overlaps between visualization, data visualization, and interaction design and UX design. I think, you know, a lot of the UX principles that we have, universal principles of design, like, you know, flexibility versus usability trade-off, you know, things like progressive disclosure, things like Ixlaw, the principle of chunking, I don't know, like signal to noise ratio, the 80-20 rule. I mean, all those universal principles are equally relevant on interaction design and UX design as they are for information visualization.
Right.
So I think from a sort of a knowledge point of view, that knowledge is shareable, right, between the disciplines. Mm-hmm. It's only the practice that might change a little bit, but you're kind of like driven by very similar sort of, again, goals and principles in many different ways.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'd actually like to see more influx from the UX world into information visualization. I mean, I myself always a bit defensive there. So whenever I meet a user experience designer, I'm always like, yeah, you know, Dataverse, it works a bit different. You know, it's not, no, you can't do it the same way. But as you say, a lot of stuff is overlapping. You know, it's just like we like to be these special ponies. But, but I mean, 90% is universal design principles, right? And
absolutely.
So I'd like to see more influence from the user experience people in the Infobus world, actually.
I agree. I think there's a huge overlap there that we should capitalize upon. I think, you know, even the audience that you have. There's noise in the background. It's your kid, man.
Yeah. It's Alma visiting.
Nice. But even the audience, like one of the things that I like about visualization, you guys probably feel the same, is the diversity of backgrounds that you have in this community, right? And the UX somehow feels a little bit like that as well. Probably not as diverse, I would say, maybe as visualization, but still, you tend to have people from, you know, psychology, cognitive science, you know, from computer science. So there's quite a diversity there as well, which I think is important to any discipline.
Yeah. I personally believe that there is so much more to do in terms of interaction design there.
Right.
Because most visualizations out there, they are not very interactive anyway. And right?
I mean, yeah, or use really obscure interaction techniques without even explaining them. Like something you wouldn't get away with as a UI or UX designer. Everybody would be like, what the fuck is going on here?
But my guess is that as visualization turns more and more interactive, then we will find ourselves adopting more of these rules that have been there for ages from interaction design, right?
Yes. Well, yeah, I certainly hope so. And I think I talk about this all the time. And I think, you know, in a given class, you know, I might say to my students, hey, interaction is key, but it doesn't solve everything. You know, you cannot just rely on interaction to, like, you know, just... Interaction
can actually be a crutch, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's why I remember, like, bringing to one of my classes, I decided to intentionally bring Giorgio Lupi, as you guys both know, to the class to show that, you know, you can achieve great work and provide a great level of insight without one single interactive element on the screen, in this case, on paper. Right. So I think it's, you know, interaction can also be somehow... demystified in a way, which because it's not the solution that solves all our problems, but still there's issues and complex networks is one of them that if you don't embrace some level of interactivity, it becomes really, really hard to do any sort of meaningful visualization of a given network, especially a really large one. So I think but like you're saying, Enrique, I think we can learn a lot from those, you know, from cognitive science, from interaction design, from UX design, because we actually share a lot of interesting principles, universal design principles that are equally benefit for all the disciplines.
Yeah, and I think as we start moving our visualizations to different devices and environments, that's going to be a key component there, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, interaction then is going to become the norm, right? The de facto sort of way of exploring data and information, for sure.
So should we wrap it up? We've been talking for, more than 1 hour now.
Wow.
I don't know, Moritz, you have other questions that you want to ask to Manuel?
Ah, no, not really. It's super, super interesting. I loved the time trip. It took me down to memory lane myself.
That's good. That's awesome.
We didn't mention the manifesto. So, if you haven't read the manifesto, post, we will link it. It's really good. And it's fun because it's 5 years old. And I think a lot of the discussion around that manifesto still resonates and is still like largely unresolved. And I think it's... That was really an interesting point. And, so we'll link that one, and you can send us comments. Or maybe we have to do a follow-up with Manuel on the manifesto.
Especially on aesthetics. I think that was the most contentious issue.
How far can you go? Manifesto. And form follows function or form follows data.
That was the genesis of the whole conversation. That was...
Horrible.
In that sense, I can leave you guys with like one of my favorite quotes when it comes to aesthetics, which is this this Dutch designer, Wim Crowell, that said, "I'm a functionalist troubled by aesthetics." And I think that's very much how I feel. I feel exactly like this, like him, right? I'm a functionalist, but always constantly troubled, tormented by aesthetics.
But... I think that manifesto was great. So before starting the episode, we had a little chat, and I said, Manuel, didn't you write this kind of information visualization manifesto so many years ago, right? And then we checked, and it was 2009, right?
Right.
Wow.
Yeah. And
if you read
nobody
it,
writes manifestos anymore. Everybody's like, whatever, it's like...
I mean, just the idea itself
of
writing
coast,
one
chaos,
was great, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember at that time I was so much influenced by that. That was great.
Yeah. Thanks, man. Yeah,
I think some of it sounds still so important. I actually like every single point you wrote. It's still very relevant. Start with a question, interactivity is key, cite your source, the power of narrative. Man, you wrote these things in 2009. It's still so important.
No, thank you.
Good stuff. And so, is there a third book coming up?
Yeah, I was going to ask the same thing.
I mean, two books, that sounds like a bit imbalanced, right? Two books.
Yeah. Let's put it this way. I need a break, but I definitely have ideas about the third book, but it's too early to say. But I'm probably going to take a break and just like get some time to to enjoy life a little bit, because this is like, you know, putting a book together, it's like really one of the most time consuming things you can do in your life. So as much as I like it, it's still very exhausting. So I definitely have ideas for a third one, but it's probably going to be on the back burner for a bit of time.
First do the week of celebrations in 2015 for OVC.
Exactly.
And then you can start your book later on.
Exactly.
If you start guessing, Moritz, it's going to be what? The book of sets? The book
it's an interesting question. Yeah, sets are a good topic, actually.
The book of, you can focus on so many things. Timelines, book of time.
There's been a book about
that. There's Cartographies of Time, which is
pretty much killed it
already.
Yeah. It's a really good one.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
All right.
Cool. Let us know. So. Yeah.
Of course. I will keep you guys posted for sure.
Cool. And thanks so much for being on the show. It's been fantastic.
Thanks so much, guys. Thanks for everything.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Manuel. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye. Bye, guys.